From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Celebrated neurologist and acclaimed writer Oliver Sacks died this week, Sunday, at 82. Sacks was best known for his books, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, about the powers and permutations of the human brain, and Awakenings, about a group of patients aroused from decades of sleeping sickness. He was often described as the poet laureate of medicine for the way he could combine science and storytelling. Awakenings became a hit movie with Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. Toward the end of his life, Oliver Sacks wrote about his impending death in a memoir and beyond. His friend, longtime friend, Lawrence Weschler, said he was writing gorgeously at the end. The most amazing thing to me, he wrote, is the way in which he basically conducted a master class in how to die after having conducted a master class in how to live and how to care and be a doctor. In July of 2013, before he focused more on death, we sat down with Oliver Sacks to talk about life and aging. This hour on Point, we bring you that conversation with Oliver Sacks. Sacks died this week of cancer. In February, he announced that earlier melanoma in his eye had spread to his liver and that he was in the late stages of terminal cancer. I spoke with him in 2013, just weeks after his 80th birthday. We talked about his op-ed in the New York Times headlined, "The Joy of Old Age." We spoke of living life, growing old, and what he looked forward to in old age. Oliver Sacks, thank you very much for joining us today, and happy birthday, sir.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You make 80 sound like it's just a big party. Really?
Well, I had a lot of parties last week, and now the parties are over and real life begins.
How's it compare to what you anticipated when you were, I don't know, 30 or 40 or 50 and looking forward to 80?
Well, I don't think I thought too much about being older, although, of course, I saw all my relatives and teachers getting older. I'm a little startled at finding myself 80, as if it happened suddenly.
What's so good about it?
Well, first, various pressures are diminished. I have a feeling of leisure and freedom and being able to do what I want. And being able to do what I want includes continuing to work. And as you said, there are long perspectives. I've seen a lot. I've been through a lot, good and bad. I've seen governments rise and fall and scientific theories rise and fall. And I think there's a breadth of mind which, provided the brain is healthy, comes with age.
So I don't know if this is possible, if memory is strong enough, but, I mean, compare a great day or a great frame of mind when you were, you name it, 30 or 40 or 50, compared to a great day and a great frame of mind now that you're 80. Are they the same thing, or is there a qualitative difference to the joy of old age, as you put it?
Well, on my 40th birthday, I went for a long swim, and on my 80th birthday, I went for a long swim.
That's good.
So I certainly enjoyed them both, but I think things had a quieter tone at 80. But that doesn't mean they were less intense. They were simply less flamboyant.
I mean, you're not in denial about where 80 puts you on the, you know, on the spectrum here. You write that you just sometimes burst out, "I'm glad I'm not dead."
Yeah, well, absolutely. When the weather is beautiful, I feel that. And of course, a third of my contemporaries are dead, and another large fraction of them have dementias or physical problems and don't have much to look forward to.
I mean, you tell this wonderful story. I guess it all depends what frame of mind you bring to it. Of Samuel Beckett in Paris with friend of yours, and your friend saying to him, "Doesn't a day like this make you glad to be alive?" And Beckett answered,
"I wouldn't go as far as that."
So what is that? Is this just your natural chemistry to be inclined toward happiness, joy, and Beckett's maybe, a bit more sour?
I'm not sure that my natural happiness does. I'm not one of the blue-eyed, optimistic people whom William James speaks about. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot I'm very grateful for, and to be happy about. I've been lucky enough to be in good health and to have friends and students. I love my work and I love writing. And at the moment, I'm still able to go sort of on all cylinders with both of these.
I mean, it's not as though you've been spared all the, you know, afflictions of, you know, you've got your joint issues, your right, and your vision issues. It's not like it's just everything's running perfectly. And yet you have this sense of fulfillment, of happiness. Where do you find it most deeply now?
I think I probably find it in work. And in the feeling that I've encompassed much more in the way of knowledge about the brain and about people, and in a sense about the universe, than I had at 60 or 40, there's a good feeling of fullness and less feeling of incompleteness. I don't know that I ever had a strong fear of death, and I don't have it now, but I used to have all sorts of regrets for what I hadn't done, and now many of the things I hadn't done I have done, and life has been kind that way.
What kind of reaction have you had to your op-ed piece? I'm sure many people read it with great interest. Everyone thinks, you know, sooner or later about age, and many people are staring straight at it or are in it. How do people respond to your headline, "The Joy of Old Age"?
Well, first, that wasn't my headline. It was the Times
ends
headline.
Up there, yes, of course.
my title was just "On Turning 80. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect this piece. It happened rather suddenly. I mentioned to a friend of mine that I'd had an odd dream about globules of mercury rising up and down. Mercury, my boyhood was full of chemistry and atomic numbers. Mercury is element 80. And somehow that dream started me off, and I wrote the piece in an hour or so and sent it off. But there have been different reactions. I think a majority of people who have anticipated decline and going down and losing it all sorts of ways, including losing the people they love, their contemporaries, you know, have been somewhat encouraged by the piece. Some people have said, well, you're just lucky and you can't speak for all of us. Some other people have got rather annoyed when I said I had no wish for any post-mortem existence or any interest in that. And they say, don't you long for heaven? Mm. And I say, no, it's I'm happy with life on this planet, which will come to an end.
I mean, maybe I wonder about the range of responses, the range of experiences. You say work is important, and we can imagine that. But then there you are, Oliver Sacks, lucky to have a very celebrated career that you can still exercise, a sense of the fullness of life or fulfillment. I mean, you know, between your books and your life, I mean, what, Robin Williams played you in Awakenings. I mean, Bill Murray sort of played you in the Royal Tenenbaums. Talk about, this is not just an invisible, sad little life. Maybe it's because you're sitting at this point on 80 years of quite noted accomplishment that you're joyful.
Well, that may be in part, but I've had many relatives who haven't perhaps had quite such a life, and they also enjoy 80. My father, who was a general practitioner, a physician in London, was going to retire at 80, but after 48 hours, he came back. He later said he thought the 80s were one of the most enjoyable decades in his life, and that he had more sense of leisure, even though he spent all day doing house calls and seeing his patients. At 90, we said, Pop, at least stop doing house calls. And he said, I'll stay with the house calls. I'll stop everything else. And so, but he enjoyed every day, I think, more intensely and perhaps more consciously when he was 80, because one doesn't know what lies ahead, whether it'll be a disease, an accident, a stroke, whatever. And so he loved going to concerts. He went to more concerts after he was 80. And he travelled more. Mm. And he loved the 80s.
Maybe younger people look a little frantic to you now in all their urgent pursuits.
Absolutely. This is sometimes the case. And certainly I'm not, you know, tormented by ambition or anxieties as much as I used to be.
What about those who aren't around anymore? What about missing them?
Intensely. I mean, one... my mother died 40 years ago. My father died 25 years ago. But I still miss them deeply. And recently I've been able to find a treasure trove of letters between my parents and myself, dating back to the early 60s when I came to America. And these have made me laugh and they've made me cry. And I do miss people intensely, but also I meet new people.
We are re-airing this hour our last interview with author and neurologist Oliver Sacks. He joined us in 2013 to talk about growing old, turning 80, and what made that time in his life special after he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times headlined The Joy of Old Age. Sacks died Sunday at 82 at his home in New York. Roel Hoffman, Nobel Prize-winning chemist, said in 2001 that Oliver Sacks humanizes illness. He writes of body and mind, and from every one of his case studies, there radiates a feeling of respect for the patient and for the illness. You can share your memories and impressions of the great neurologist and writer on Facebook or Twitter at On Point Radio this hour and at our website, onpointradio.org. How do you remember Oliver Sacks? After a short break, we'll hear more of my 2013 interview with neurologist and writer Oliver Sacks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening back this hour to my 2013 interview with celebrated neurologist and author Oliver Sacks. He died on Sunday at his home in New York at 82. Though Sacks began his medical career as a researcher, he gave up pure research early, saying he had neither the temperament nor the hand-eye coordination for test tubes and lab work. Instead, he turned to clinical practice and to writing. Sacks was a prolific writer. He wrote personally revealing essays about his experiences experimenting with LSD and other drugs in the 60s. Much of his work, though, focused on his patients. He's best known for his books like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Awakenings, The Mind's Eye, among others. In 2002, Oliver Sacks was awarded the Lewis Thomas Prize for Science Writing. The citation said, "Sacks presses us to follow him into uncharted regions of human experience and compels us to realize once there that we are confronting only ourselves." In my 2013 interview with Sacks, we sat down to talk about getting older. He'd written an op-ed piece in the New York Times reflecting on turning 80. It was headlined, "The Joy of Old Age." We talked about Nora Ephron's not-as-joyful take on getting older. In 2006, writer and director Nora Ephron published the best-selling book, "I Feel Bad About My Neck." When Martha Stewart asked her on her show why the book was selling so well, Nora Ephron reflected on what the alternatives were for her aging audience. You'll hear them here, then Oliver Sacks and me.
They're all going out and they're finding these books that are called, I've started reading these books and they're called things like The Joy of Menopause. I don't think so. Your Happy Golden Years. And I kept thinking, what is wrong with these people? Don't they have necks? Don't they go past the mirror and go,
wow,
I'm not looking at that. You know, that thing you start doing at a certain age, which is you see a mirror and you just close your eyes.
Nora Ephron there, The Joy of Menopause, The Joy of Aging. She wasn't exactly buying it. Her neck bothered her, Oliver Sacks. I mean, back in the day, you were a big-time weightlifter. I think you lifted 600 pounds once, sort of taking the prize in California. You must have been some specimen. What about all the physical falling apart, you know, the replaced knees and all the rest?
Well, I certainly have replaced knees and all the rest. And on one occasion, I was visited by a fellow weightlifter. He'd had a medal in the Olympics, and we looked at each other and said, what fools we were.
Meaning?
Meaning the body can't quite take that, you know, extreme exercise. You may be strong enough, but the ligaments and the tendons and so forth and the discs will break down. But but still, I was very happy to do it when I was 30. Actually, I was 28. And I got that Californian record.
600 pounds, that's incredible. So now, I mean, I've seen the laundry list, and everybody's got one at a certain age. Are you self-pitying about those physical impediments, or do they matter as much anymore?
I had a cancer, a melanoma in my eye, mm-hmm. Which was irradiated. That eye now has no vision, but the cancer hasn't recurred. I sort of said to the cancer, you can have the eye, but leave me alone.
But
and
don't
so
take
far,
me.
So far, this is what the cancer has done. My balance is a bit bad, and when I'm outside, especially with crowds rushing around, I use a stick.
Cane.
And I don't drive because my vision is somewhat bad. On the other hand, I can read, although I use a magnifying glass. I write up a storm. And I can swim up a storm. I love swimming, and I feel young and strong or ageless in the water. I think swimming is one of the few activities one can do, you know, for the first century.
Yeah, thank heavens for the first century. Thank heavens for water. I'm trying to think what sets you apart. Maybe not. We'll hear in a moment from the growing list of people who want to speak with you. But I noted here, reading in your background, you've been in psychoanalysis for 46 years with the same Freudian psychoanalyst. Is that key to your mental health, to the joy you find at 80?
Well, he's not at all doctrinaire, but he certainly knows me very well. And I think he likes me, which helps me like myself, which I haven't always done. And again, I think I'm lucky there, and more than lucky, I've had a lot of impulsive and destructive trays with drugs and other ways, and my friends didn't expect me to make 30, let alone 40. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly due to the good analysts that I've actually reached 80.
As a reporter out in the world, some years ago, I spoke with the oldest man in the world, or at least that was the claim, 120. He lived in a little island way down south of Japan, down toward what China and Japan are feuding about now, tiny island. And, of course, you'd have to ask, you know, what's the secret of your long life? He said that he thought it was that he had not even left this tiny island until he was 40. He hadn't married until he was 50. He had just done everything late. I thought of that as I read your piece. You were in earlier decades of your life, Oliver Sacks. You were, forgive me, but I think everybody says sort of, you say, morbidly shy. You were kind of a late bloomer. Could that be related to your happiness now?
No, I think the shyness is more an affliction than anything else. Mm-hmm. There's something to be said for late blooming. Because late blooming may be part of a continued blooming. With something like music or mathematics, one starts very early. But where an experience of life is concerned, I think it has to be relatively late. By the way,
yes.
I once saw an interview with the two oldest women in the world, though they were only 114.
Yeah.
When they were asked what contributed, the one in Holland said, "Have herring." She had herring every day.
Yeah, okay.
And the one in Texas said, "Minding my own business."
Herring and minding your own business. Herring every day. My grandfather should have lived longer, if that's the secret. Oliver Sacks is with us. He turned 80 last week, and it's pretty darn good, he says. Harry in Burlington, Vermont. Harry, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Oliver Sacks.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And first, I want to say it's a to speak with you. I have a question. I'm a cartoonist, and I come from a family of working illustrators and visual artists. And it seems as though we're all sort of collectively inspired as we all get old. I'm 50. And I wondered if there have been any sort of studies that have been done relating to creative people and how they feel about getting older, because it seems that, like I said, we all have this, you know, awe of the world. But I was curious if there have been any studies done with creative people versus, say, lawyers.
Of course, there are some creative lawyers. But how about it, Oliver Sacks, creative people and aging?
Well, I think creating is a both a task and a joy which can sustain one even when one is quite ill and keep one going. But in a mysterious way, there are people who discover talents in old age. I have a cousin who's now 88, and he discovered when he was 80 that he could paint. He'd never really painted before, and now he's a bit of a Grandma Moses. I have a few cartoonists in my own family. Al Capp was a second cousin of mine.
Little Abner.
Little Abner.
No kidding. Wow.
And two of his sibs were also natural cartoonists.
Yeah.
I think conductors can especially live to an old age, not only the art, but they're tremendously energetic on stage, and so they get aerobic exercise all the while. But I think being creative certainly helps.
Though it's no guarantee. You write in your essay that W.H. Auden, the poet who was a friend of yours, you write, had told you that he thought he would live to 80 and then bugger off, he said. But he only lived to 67. And he, talk about creative, he was right up there.
And with a tremendous thinker like Immanuel Kant, he got something like Alzheimer's disease. When he had it, he was still ambitious. He said he wanted to write some critiques, a critique of pure reason. And his friend said, Immanuel, you've already done it.
There it is. Anne in Middlesex, Vermont. Anne, you're on the air with Oliver Sacks.
Hi. I'm 55, and I observed my father-in-law, who had a very, very wonderful life. And I observed him as he was getting older, being very, very satisfied, and looking, he could look back on his life and be happy about everything he had accomplished. He was an exceptional person. And I learned from that, observing that we who are younger, and I try to do this, try to live our lives so that it's hard, but try to live our lives so that we have as few regrets as possible to look back on when we are older.
You think that's going to provide happiness or longevity or?
No, I just think more just relaxed and not stressed about, oh, I should have raised my child differently or, you know, the big issues and the small, some, you know, just try to be, well, your prior hour was about heroin addiction and, you know, just try to get through these things so that you can live a life that you can look back on and be satisfied with.
Anne, thanks for that. Dr. Sacks, how about it? A life without regrets, or few regrets anyway, as an ideal backdrop for happiness later.
Well, this is certainly much better than a life which is full of regrets. But I think one needs to look forward as well as looking back. I think looking back and being nostalgic isn't enough. You have to have things which engage you at the moment and which you can look forward to. But I know one very accomplished writer who has written 24 marvelous books, and he's a little younger than I am. He says, I hate old age. And I'm not quite sure why he says that, because he certainly has a full life and has had a life full of accomplishment. But one is no longer the person one was, at least in terms of, in some ways, physically.
Oliver Sacks saying, well, there are compensations. He's kind of happy with the person he is. There can be joy in it. Let's take a call, if we may, from Los Angeles, California. Saad is calling. Saad, good to hear from you. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is actually for the doctor, the neurologist. What has he learned from his patients over the years that a patient or a person can do to decrease or retard the decline in mental psychological functioning between the age of 80 and 90? And I mean by that habits, lifestyle, or even medications, drugs. Thank you.
There's a very practical question for the doctor in Oliver Sacks, the neurologist. How about it, sir, Dr. Sacks? Okay.
Well, I, among other places, I have worked in old age homes for the last 40 years, sometimes wonderful ones like the Little Sisters of the Poor, and sometimes horrifying ones, which I won't name. People get into these homes either because of illness, that may be a dementia, a stroke, blindness, whatever, or because perhaps they have been bereaved and they've become isolated and they want to live in community. I think the sense of community is tremendously important for old people, and being isolated is really dangerous. But certainly, as the years advance towards... well, my friend Paul Theroux says he has a 103-year-old mother, and he attributes her longevity to the fact that she has never taken any medicine. But that's pretty rare, and most of us have more and more medicines and more conditions as we get older.
Yeah.
But we adapt or compensate, or we don't. I mean, compensation is always partial.
Lucky for Mother Theroux there.
Yeah.
But the medicine chest is not where you first look. Oliver Sacks, stand by in Washington if you'd be kind enough. And Saad, good to hear from you in Los Angeles. With us from San Francisco right now is Louise Aronson. She's a professor of geriatrics at University of California, San Francisco, directs the Northern California Geriatric Education Center, author of A History of Present Illness. Louise Aronson, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
What do you see as the factors that determine what type of old age one might have? Oliver Sacks is finding a fair amount of joy in his. What's the factors that might lead that way?
Well, I tend to think of five factors that really determine or influence strongly old age, and one of them is genes. So when we were talking about Mama Theroux, it may just be that she has great genes.
People or Papa Sacks, the 90-something doctor still working
well,
on her
exactly. Sexton. Well, exactly. 94-year-old, I was going to say that Dr. Sacks comes from good genes as well. That people who live into their 90s and 100s tend to have siblings and parents who have done the same thing. Mm-hmm. So some of it is genes. There's a factor of luck. You know, did a car hit you or not? Various things like that.
But that's just
money,
years. You know, what about happiness or, you know,
right,
frame of mind?
So exactly. So I think you and Dr. Sacks also discussed about engagement and social support. And we know these things make a huge difference. And engagement can take lots of forms. Most of us will not be writing such great books as Dr. Sacks, but even engagement with one's grandchildren or one's community or one's friends can make a huge difference. Another thing that influences aging, disability, and life at all ages is exercise. And you can start exercising at any age. It's perfectly safe to do so. And in fact, one of my favorite studies was from, I think, 20 years ago now. A researcher in Boston, actually, who looked at people in their 80s, 90s, and early 100s and have them start exercising. Start exercising.
Yeah.
All were able to do so, and their ability to do the things they wanted to do and to feel independent and have meaningful lives increased, so that people who were using canes, many of them no longer needed it. People who hadn't walked stairs were, again, able to walk stairs.
I think I heard you say money there as well, if I'm not mistaken. What about money?
Well, money makes a difference. If you look at happiness and life satisfaction, people in the upper income groups tend to have higher satisfaction. It's, you know, money alone will not bring you happiness. But in studies across many countries, people with more money have more happiness, and it sort of makes sense. If you think about Dr. Sacks talking about his life of leisure and freedom, some of that comes with having enough money that you know you can live in a comfortable place and you can live safely. And if you want to go somewhere, even if you can't drive, you can afford to get there.
We are listening back this hour to my 2013 interview with celebrated neurologist and acclaimed author Oliver Sacks. He died Sunday in New York at 82 of melanoma. His longtime assistant said the doctor had a very good death in the same way he'd had a very good life. In my 2013 interview with Sachs, we talked about getting older, embracing life, reflecting on turning 80, and his 2012 book, Hallucinations. When we come back, more of that conversation. What do you remember about the life of Oliver Sacks? You can share your own memories and impressions on Facebook or Twitter at On Point Radio and at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Writer and neurologist Oliver Sacks died Sunday at 82. We're listening back to my last interview with him in 2013. Sacks was celebrated for his best-selling books on brain disorders. He first won widespread attention in 1973 for his book Awakenings, about awakening a group of catatonic patients of sleeping sickness who were wasting away at a hospital in the Bronx. The book was made into a movie in 1990, nominated for 3 Oscars. It starred Robin Williams as Dr. Malcolm Sayer, the character based on Oliver Sacks.
Your patients, Doctor, haven't moved in decades.
What I believe, what I know, is these people are alive inside.
How do you know that, Doctor?
I know it.
He wrote many other books, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, The Mind's Eye, Hallucinations, to name a few. In 2013, Oliver Sacks spoke with me about growing old and living life without regrets. Dr. Louise Aronson also joined us. She's a professor of geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, where she directs the Northern California Geriatric Education Center. In the interview, we spoke with Oliver Sacks about his New York Times op-ed piece, written just before his 80th birthday, headlined, The Joy of Old Age.
In the piece I wrote, I am not generalizing. It's a personal piece.
Yes, indeed.
I'm very much aware of being lucky. In my professional work, I see many old people who have been very unlucky and missing out on genes as well and all the other factors which Dr. Aronson spoke of. Mm-hmm. But even things which seem awful can sometimes be put to good use. A lot of my elderly patients are blind or deaf, but intact intellectually. But those who are blind tend to get visual hallucinations. And these at first are startling. One feels, what's going on? Am I going down the tubes? You may feel powerless to change them. But then, sooner or later, the majority of these people with hallucinations feel easier about it, and they may sometimes enjoy it, and they may sometimes employ them. There was a poet, Virginia Adair, who wrote poetry as a young woman and then turned to lecturing in English. When she was in her 70s, she lost her eyesight and she started having these hallucinations, but she was able to they really re-inspired her and got her poetic voice going again. So she wrote her first book of poetry when she was blind and hallucinated and 83 years old. And I will generalize to the extent that I think all people can, I think, be helped to find a way of life despite their limitations, which is healthier and happier.
Well, hallucinations may be available to all. I mean, I remember my grandmother, who was quite clear-minded well into her age, but she would have long conversations when she thought no one was around with my grandfather, who had been dead for some years. I don't know if they qualify as hallucinations exactly. What about you, Oliver Sacks?
Well, incidentally, no, I think that does. And the bereavement hallucinations are quite common, something like a third of the people who've lost a husband or wife will hallucinate faces or voices. and they tend to find these hallucinations comforting and part of the mourning process. I had lots of drug-induced hallucinations myself when I was younger, and now I'm half blind. I get some of these visual hallucinations. I think actually they're rather fun, and they're certainly very interesting. They tell one a lot about the brain.
A kind of library,
but, yeah.
you may borrow from. Louise, what about it? This question about resources and aging. I mean, many people in their most senior years have quite modest resources available to them. You visit a lot of people. Do you find them necessarily despairing because they're, you know, not out on a yacht in the Greek Isles?
Well, there were sources apart from being on a yacht in the Greek Isles.
Yes.
As Dr. Aronson said, being in community, being engaged is tremendously important to the extent which one can be. And some sort of resource can be found for everyone, external resources, but also inner resources, whatever form it takes.
Louise, what's your experience on this question of resources and happiness?
Right, I would have to agree. I mean, I think resources give you options, but internal resources are key. And I'm constantly amazed at the resilience of all of us as human beings. And there are people who are in circumstances that seem almost unimaginably horrible. Really tiny rooms, maybe there are infestations, not many visitors, very, very few resources as we usually define them. And some of those people are very happy, and other people are maybe in less compromised circumstances, but still limited circumstances, and they find a way to get joy from the people they do interact with, or from television, or increasingly, it's actually amazing what the internet has done for people who might otherwise mm-hmm. be isolated.
Yeah.
And of course, some people don't have the resources to get to it, but more and more there are options for people, and people's grandkids and great-grandkids can help them out with that. So I think there are many, many people who do suffer tremendously because they just can't do any of the things physically or mentally they want to. And yet a lot of people with those same disabilities seem to manage to enjoy life and find pleasure in it. There was actually a huge study earlier this year that looked at satisfaction across life.
Hmm.
And while people had different rates of happiness, and those with more money tended to be more happy, and certain generations that had grown up without a major economic depression tended to be happier than those who mm-hmm. grew up in a depression,
mm-hmm.
at all ages, life satisfaction increased with age.
Duly noted, and good to know. Jim in Wanakee, Wisconsin. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Dr. Sachs, I particularly enjoyed your book called Migraine. I'm 69, retired, and really enjoying the new life in retirement. But
great.
I had, at one point in my life, had a real problem with the kind of migraines that cause vertigo and loss of balance, and I couldn't even walk. But I read your book, and it was so supportive and helpful. And I just want to say that, I appreciate what you're doing today and the books you write. They're very supportive and helpful. And I like your positive attitude and the flexibility. I had an experience growing up when I was a sophomore in high school. I was the strongest kid in my class, and I was able to, you're talking about the weightlifting.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to put 220 pounds over my head. That was much more than I weighed. But now, as a senior citizen, I can't lift 20, but I got to thinking about that. Well, I'm not the same person, but I have power in a lot of other ways, like I've started a new career in art, and I've kind of left my profession, behind me, thinking that, well, I had a hard time adjusting to retirement, but now seeing with all the flexible things, reading and understanding all the options that are out there, it's a whole new world, and it's very encouraging.
Jim, that's great to hear, and we hear your thanks to Oliver Sacks for encouraging that flexibility. Wonderful. Thanks for calling from Wisconsin there. Dr. Sachs, what about the flexibility, and what about these new powers? Jim can't, lift a house over his head anymore, but he's finding new powers in age.
Well, first, I think what was brought out was that retirement has to be active and has to be a new opening and not just a renunciation of what one has been doing. I think retirement can be dangerous and it must be an active retirement. But certainly for all sorts of people, including the blind and the deaf, our digital age provides possibilities of communication which would have been unimaginable 20 years ago. Mm. And even the traditional old age homes where I work sort of are wired up and in digital contact with others.
Fire up the Skype, and there you are. Linnea is calling from Belmont, Vermont. Linnea, you're on with Oliver Sacks and Louise Aronson.
Hello.
Hi.
I really enjoyed this conversation. One of the things, and it's been touched upon, I have always felt that at any given age, one should have a passion. It should be a passion that will sustain you throughout your life. I don't, for instance, one can raise flowers. You don't need to be wealthy to raise flowers. You just go buy seeds and, you know, mm-hmm. go on from there. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it helps certainly to have money, yes, but I'm not sure that it's all that important. I think if one lives very middle class or even a bit under, as long as they, as you have mentioned, you know, maintain friendships and go out and do things. I have been retired for 10 years. I'm turning 70. Mm-hmm. I'm blessed with very good health. I have always studied classical piano, even though I was a nurse. I always managed to somehow study. I'm in two music clubs. We're all older, but it's amazing. There are people, there's one woman, she's 92. She still will give her own recital. And it's just miraculous. But again, I think the idea of having a passion and loving something is important.
Linnea, you put it so well. Oliver Sacks, you warn of the dangers of puttering about the garden, but if you're really passionate about it, maybe that's different. And piano as well.
Well, if you're a gardener and if you're in love with nature, no, I agree entirely. Which has given me a huge amount of pleasure and passion, was getting a music teacher when I was 75. I had played the piano as a kid, but my original music teacher died when I was 12. But now the piano gives me huge pleasure, although it may drive my neighbors mad.
Let me get one more. Alex in Stratford, Connecticut. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is sort of going on the other end of the spectrum to the younger years.
Yes.
I remember a memory when I was around 8 or 9 years old and diving into the revelations of the Bible and seeing the finality of life. And at a young age, I was struck by that, and it devastated me. But as I got older, I actually became a philosophy major. I made peace with the fact that I'll be getting older. I'm only 25 now. But, you know, as time goes on, I'm at peace with that. And I'm wondering if, you know, struggling with that question at a young age, if that has anything to do with being at peace with yourself as you get older, as you, you know, look towards, you know, the end, you know, so to speak.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, let us pick it up, Alex. Oliver Sacks, first to you. Do you think that somehow, you know, the way we think about the world in our early years, the way we even look at mortality or aging, does it affect how it actually turns out in the end, in your experience or observation, Oliver?
Well, I think one can feel invulnerable and almost immortal when one is younger. I used to ride a motorbike and sometimes rather fast and foolishly, and which I wouldn't have done had I had some of the wisdom of age. I had a near-death experience on a mountain when I was 40, and from that time on, I realized that dying was a reality. Personally, I am fairly happy and with the thought that dying is final, and that's that. But I do not try and dissuade people who want to think in terms of an afterlife, and in some of the Catholic homes I work in, people look forward to this very much, and sort of good for them.
Louise, what about the view beyond death? Different people have different views. Does it make an obvious difference that you've observed in terms of their happiness in the latter part of this life?
Yes, I think it has less to do with what they specifically believe and more to do with whether what they believe provides them with comfort. So the people who seem to struggle most feel like there something will happen that they don't want and they just can't cope with it. And other people come to terms with the fact that life will end and want to live as well as they can up until that point. And other people look forward to what comes after. And they find comfort in that, and they've sort of resolved it in a way that they can live with. So it's very individual, but it seems to matter more whether you feel okay about your what you think will happen or whether you're unable to cope with or terrified by what you think will happen. So engaging with it in some way and coming to some understanding with it makes a big difference.
Oliver Sacks, is looking back part of a pleasurable activity for you now, even hallucinating, I don't know, back? What are you hallucinating lately, sir?
Only sort of geometrical patterns, mostly. Nothing much beyond that. No, I look back on many things with pleasure and gratitude. I look back on a few other things with horror. I'm writing a sort of autobiography at the moment, but one also needs, I think, to look forward, and to have new interests all the while, and I think I feel that as well.
That was celebrated neurologist and writer Oliver Sacks speaking with me in 2013 about getting older, reflecting on turning 80, and embracing life, looking backward and looking forward. In those last few minutes of our interview, he spoke of his memoir, On the Move, which came out this April. Oliver Sacks died Sunday in New York after a battle with melanoma. He was 82. He wrote about his terminal cancer diagnosis in a February op-ed in the New York Times, saying, "When people die, they cannot be replaced. They leave holes that cannot be filled, for it is the fate, the genetic and neural fate, of every human being to be a unique individual, to find his own path, to live his own life, to die his own death. My predominant feeling," Sacks wrote, "is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I have been given much and have given something in return. I've read and traveled and thought and written. Above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet. And that in itself," he wrote, "has been an enormous privilege and adventure." Thanks for joining us this hour to hear Oliver Sacks one more time. You can share your thoughts on life and aging and on the work and perspective of Oliver Sacks on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio and at our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.